Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with John Rawling, Ian Dark and me, Tris Dixon. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. This week we are looking at some of the phenomenons, some of the popular fighters from through the years. And we wanted to do this partly, I think, because of what's going on in the heavyweight division now with the likes of Joshua and Fury and Fury and Usyk and sort of waging these popularity contests between A-sides and B-sides. But it was a far simpler time when the whole nation got behind the likes of Sir Henry Cooper. Am I right or am I wrong, John?
Oh, totally. I mean, Henry, I think, first became a British champion in 1959. And he goes all the way through to fighting Joe Bugner in the early 70s. And through that time, because all his fights had been shown on the BBC, and there was, you know, it was either BBC, ITV or nothing back in those days, the whole country seemed to know Henry. And win or lose, he was a national treasure. And the country loved him, I think, in a way that no other fighter since has quite touched. His popularity was quite extraordinary. He might not have sold 80,000 tickets as in the modern era at Wembley Stadium too often, if at all. But actually, in terms of just public consciousness and love which he had from the sporting public, I don't think Henry's popularity has ever been matched since. Maybe Barry McGuigan came close, but I don't think anybody else.
Ian, what's your take on that? And what made Henry so popular?
Well, let's look at what makes a fighter popular. So I wrote down some things. A marquee style, somebody who's in pretty dramatic fights, does entertaining interviews with a touch of personality, character, charisma. You could be like a bloke next door, which is, I think, was the Ricky Hatton, Henry Cooper appeal. Maybe a little bit of a maverick or just kind of eccentric in some way. And yeah, like John says, you've got to be on the TV, really. Otherwise, people don't know you. So it's that kind of thing, I think, that people latch on to. Let's just delay on Henry for a moment, because John summed up that pretty well, and go to Tyson Fury now. Where would he be in the popularity stakes? I mean, he's currently in a situation where he doesn't seem to want to fight this guy Usyk, does he, at all? He makes all kinds of demands which seem to change, and Usyk, in the end, agrees to a 30%, 70% split in Fury's favour, and he still doesn't want the fight. Now he's demanding they knock out the rematch clause. So, you know, I never use the phrase running scared, because fighters don't run scared. They're brave people. But it doesn't look like he particularly wants the fight, does it?
No, and I don't like, I mean, this is probably making me sound like some real old fart, but I don't like the way in which Tyson now habitually makes his case on social media. You know, I don't think it's necessary to be effing and blinding. I don't think it's necessary to be abusive. And he's doing it just absolutely habitually now. And once upon a time, the British Boxing Board of Control would have suspended a fighter or fined them heavily, but probably suspended them for promoting themselves in the manner that Tyson habitually does. And I think he doesn't do boxing a service. I don't think he does himself a service by doing that. You know, he talks about legacy, but does he really want to be a legacy for effing and blinding on YouTube? I personally don't see it.
But I think there are people who they do admire, don't they? I think people's view of Tyson Fury has changed in the last few years. I think he's projected this image of somebody who's been through a lot of very bad times with drugs and depression and that sort of thing and prevailed. So I take my hat off to him for all of that. I think he's been a great example for a lot of people. But I'm with you, John. It's probably right. We're old fuddy-duddies, and I don't think probably the modern fans don't care too much about the language. But no, he doesn't need to be doing that. But, you know, this is this era.
Yeah, I suppose in terms of the size of the audience, if you're effing and jeffing like that, you know, it's not like the BBC are going to pick up your tweets with that stuff on and put it on and broadcast it. So obviously you're talking about reaching hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people. Well, as soon as they hear Fury talking like that, they just won't run it, will they?
No, but people still have access to it. That's the point. You know, I mean, young kids can see that. Mm. And I personally, you know, I mean, my children are now older than that and are old enough to make their own decisions. But I still wouldn't, 10 years ago, have liked them to have been witness to that. And there's no, you know, there's no filter on this stuff, is there? And if Henry was still around now, I think that he would have absolutely despised the way in which a lot of the modern fights are being publicized.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
I mean, it's just part of Tyson Fury's shtick, isn't it? Which some people like and some people definitely don't like.
Hey, I like him as a fighter. And I think he's a terrific talent. And I think, you know, when you talk about the most popular fighters, one way or another, Tyson Fury's got to be right up there. You don't sell out the Tottenham Hotspur Football Stadium and Wembley Stadium by accident. He puts himself across and he resonates with the public, you know, like it or dislike it. But I was really just taking the opportunity to say, I think that there are nicer ways of doing it than he does.
Going back to Henry, I mean, John summed it up very, very well. People just loved him. You know, a few years ago, before he died, I asked him if he'd come and talk at my son's school assembly. And he said, I'm not sure I really want to do it, you know, Ian. He said, because nobody knows who I am anymore. And I said, you're kidding, Henry, aren't you? Anyway, he did it. When he walked in, he'd taken one step through the door of the hall and the entire audience, made up of people who never saw him fight, were up on their feet, clapping and cheering. And I mean, I don't think he could believe it, that all those years on, he still had that sort of resonance and would still have that kind of popularity. I mean, I think to add, you said nobody's come close soon. I think Frank Bruno's come pretty close. He'd get that kind of reaction, I think, if he walked into a room even now.
Yeah, maybe. I suppose perhaps I'm being unfair to Frank there. There was an extraordinary warmth to Henry, wasn't there? I mean, we worked with him as a co-commentator, and it was almost as though you were acting as his minder, never mind his co-commentator, trying to usher him through the crowds, you know, the thousands of people who'd come and want to slap him on the back. You know, goodness knows what it'd be like now, you know, in the era of selfies and photographs. You know, he was massive. And as you rightly said, Ian, it was like with Ricky Hatton. It was the boy next door. He was so very, very down to earth, wasn't he? And Barry had that as well. Barry had that. You know, he didn't have longevity in his fame, Barry. He had that great time in 1985 into 1986, didn't he? When he captivated the nation, I think, because of the troubles in Northern Ireland, and people were seeing another side of Northern Ireland, and he was giving Belfast something good to talk about, and there wasn't too much good in those days, and he kind of captured the public in a way, again, in a way that perhaps modern fighters, albeit the popularity of Joshua and Fury is undeniable, maybe in a way that they don't quite do the same.
Mm. I mean, Henry always used to have a great sense of humour. People wouldn't have seen that too much as well. I remember once I asked him to do like an April Fool's gag. to put on radio two, as it then was, with Sports Report, where and he was 54 and he pretended he was going to go. He did it brilliantly about how he was going to make a comeback against George Foreman. It was around the time Foreman was making his, you know, having his second career. And, you know, Henry did this interview and he kind of, he dressed it up beautifully. He says, yeah, well, I've looked at Foreman and I thought, well, why not me? You know, I can go down the gym. And I went down the gym and yeah, still felt okay. The timing was still there on the jab and you never lose the power in the left hook. And, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to go over and maybe do a bit of sparring and we can do the fight and make a bit of money together. And he completely fooled everyone as well. I had the Sunday Mirror ringing up after the program saying, can you give us the tape of that? That's an amazing story. They bought it hook, line and sinker, but it wouldn't have worked without Henry just sort of playing the role. He was really up for a practical joke.
It's funny, though, isn't it? Because when with Henry, his popularity, it didn't necessarily rub off on his opponents. And in that respect, Ian, Joe Bugner never had a chance, did he, to become a darling of the nation?
No, he didn't. I mean, and, you know, and a lot of that stemmed from that big fight in 1971, where Henry was perceived to have been robbed against Joe Bugner, largely because of Harry Carpenter's commentary, I think, which said, I can't believe they can take away his title like that. And we know that Henry never spoke to the referee, Harry Gibbs, again, I don't think, after that fight. But, you know, I wasn't there. It was before my time covering the sport. But I spoke to a lot of the reporters, the Boxing Beat reporters who were around and at that fight. And they all said, phony controversy. It wasn't a very good fight and it was pretty close. So no scandal as far as we were concerned. So in that regard, Joe was a bit unlucky, wasn't he, on the popularity stake? I mean, there was always that feeling with Joe that, you know, maybe he wasn't in love with the business and maybe he didn't lay it all on the line. But he was a really top defensive fighter, Joe.
When he fought Joe Frazier, you know, I mean, go back, people who've not seen Joe Bugner fight and who maybe hear the negatives from, you know, from when he fought Ali in Kuala Lumpur and really just went 15 rounds to survive and take the money. But people who wonder whether or not he could fight, go back and rewatch that fight against Joe Frazier, who was an absolute, you know, formidable heavyweight of his time. And Joe Bugner matched him all the way. It was an outstanding performance. And yeah, I actually, you know, when you're talking about popularity of fighters, I met Joe Bugner and liked him. And I think it's a shame, really, that the public never forgave him for something that wasn't really his fault. And if you go back and view that fight against Henry Cooper, there's a very, very good argument that Joe actually won that fight. You know, and he's gone through his whole career, he's got through his whole life since that, with having something of a stigma attached to him. I gather, incidentally, that he's now gone into a care home in Brisbane, suffering from advanced dementia, which is very, very sad. You know, he's another boxing statistic added to that problem, which Triz outlined so vividly in his recent book.
He did have some kind of marquee value, didn't he? Even when he came back and fought, do you remember, for Frank Warren, and had that sort of second career, which ended with the fight against Bruno at White Hart Lane at Tottenham. Yeah. But, you know, he did a lot, really, and I'm sure Frank Warren had confirmed this, to put Frank Warren on the map. And, you know, he's getting good TV ratings. He might have been not number one in the popularity stakes, but he was a big name. He was a respected, revered name. And people tuned in to see, well, what's he got left? Let's have a look at him again. And Joe made a bit of money out of it, of course. And I think it did Frank a favour. So, you know, he was a good story still.
He knew how to play the game.
I think he was better second time around than first time around. He really did know how to play the media, didn't he, second time around?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting when we talk about these divisive characters, Ian, because obviously there have been plenty of them through the years. When you look at Nassim Hamed, when you look at Chris Eubank, these are guys that people love but have also loved to hate. Floyd Mayweather, you can add to the list. I mean, it's hard to say that these guys are popular, but they are, aren't they? It's not just being divisive. People tune in to watch them and to support them, and they do idolize them. But then there are a segment of fans, and maybe a not inconsiderable section of fans, who tune in to see these guys get beaten.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, there are people you'd say there's a, like maybe a little league of people who should have made more popular than they were. You might even include Lennox Lewis in that list, because maybe not so much in Britain, where I think in the end he really was revealed for his longevity as a heavyweight champion and regarded as a great. But not in America. I mean, in America, I used to hear it all the time, just along the row from me, in fact, from the HBO commentators who'd say, I remember Jim Lampley saying to me one day when he'd fought Mavrovich, I just wish your son of a bitch would go and get into a fight sometimes. And I said, well, he does what he does to win. I said, he's not giving the other guy a chance he doesn't have in the fight. I said, it's pretty sensible. And it's why he's still around and stayed around at the top so long. So, yeah, but I don't think Lennox was quite, had a quite a cool personality, didn't he, with the public. He wasn't the kind of guy who was going to go on and rip up trees in a big personality performance on TV. Classy, dignified, but probably, I don't know whether the nation truly warmed to him. They warmed to his talent, maybe not so much as a personality. You're right, Nassim Hamed, a lot of people bought tickets to see him get beaten, I think. Chris Eubank was the same. A lot of people want to see him put in his place. And they always say the same thing in boxing, don't they, in the end. Doesn't matter why people buy the tickets or the pay-per-view as it is now, as long as they do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Floyd Mayweather always used to say, it doesn't matter if you love me or hate me, but, providing you have an opinion about me, I'm relevant.
Don King used to say that. I remember writing articles, including, as usual, some pretty florid stuff on Don King. And I remember people, I was writing for The Guardian at the time, and people on the desk saying, you sure you can say that? You can't say, that's libelous. And I said, trust me, you can say it. Because Don King was very much of the P.T. Barnum way of promoting, wasn't he? Don't worry about, I don't care about what you say, as long as you're talking about me. He wasn't going to see you in court. He just wanted to see his name in the papers.
Do you remember when he was at that press conference, Don King, sitting next to Carl the Truth Williams, and one of the American reporters said, you're sitting next to Carl the Truth Williams there. Don, is that the closest you've ever been to the truth? Great question. It only happened at boxing press conferences. Great lines like that.
Yeah, it's great stuff. So it's exciting as these guys start to build. I mean, we have mentioned Ricky Hatton. We knew that he was a ticket seller, shall we say, from the start. But obviously, he became this phenomenon who would take, depending on who you believe, 20, 25, 30,000 out to Vegas. Obviously, fill stadiums in the UK and all the rest of it. They build generally, gradually, don't they? I mean, is there anyone that you can remember who is almost like an overnight success? And I suppose when we touched upon the heavyweight division, John, could you maybe put... Anthony Joshua in that, in terms of coming out with the gold medal and pushing on, because he was a big draw from the start, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, nobody, I mean, okay, if you followed amateur boxing, you heard of him and you knew of him, but really the wider public knew nothing about Anthony Joshua until he won that gold medal. And there's a fairly persuasive argument that he was a little bit fortunate to win the gold medal. You know, I mean, people who know their boxing saw him fight Savon in the quarterfinal, and a lot of people thought he lost that. And there are plenty who thought he was a bit fortunate to win the gold medal. But, I mean, you've got to give huge credit to Eddie Hearn thereafter, and indeed to Anthony, for playing the game and being manoeuvred into a position whereby his popularity became just phenomenal, didn't it? He won a world title by beating one of the least talented world champions that you could ever wish to see in the heavyweight division, a bloke called Charles Martin, who I suspect wasn't even particularly famous in his hometown, but he got that. And then he went on and just became a phenomenal success. So, I mean, the Klitschko fight in 2017 was wildly exciting, wasn't it? And he just attained massive fame as a result, I think, of that fight as much as anything.
He was lucky as well, wasn't he, that he fought Klitschko when Klitschko was 41, because I thought there were moments in that fight where Klitschko, the younger Klitschko or a younger version of him, would have been able to pull the trigger and get the job done, but he didn't. I mean, great credit to AJ, because he came through about 9 minutes of that fight where he just looked pretty woozy and looked ready to be taken out, but somehow stayed in the fight and got it done in the end. So great credit to him, and, you know, good luck to him. He became massively marketable, and I am amazed. I am really amazed that him against Fury never happened. Look how much money that fight would have been worth, say, 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it would still sell. It would still sell, but not in the numbers it would have done then. And, you know, looking at AJ, who became massively popular and, you know, filled Wembley Stadium and all that sort of thing, and the O2 Arena, bad decision for me. I mean, as well as Eddie Hearn did guide him, bad decision to fight Usyk again. Because like John and I always used to say when we joked in coffee shops and on the strip in, you know, in Vegas or in Atlantic City or somewhere, you'd seen the fight. You'd seen the fight. Usyk's technically too good for AJ. So why put him in with him again and get him beaten again? Make him even more damaged goods. I thought that was a lousy decision.
And now you've got the comeback fight against Franklin, which is proving to be a fairly difficult sale. You know, I mean, he's plummeted in the esteem of the boxing public, and indeed of the, you know, the people who go out and buy tickets in their bundles just to be part of an event. That's been a hugely damaging defeat to his career, and it's I think it's very, very questionable whether or not AJ is going to be able to recover as the sort of draw that he was prior to the defeat against Ruiz, and particularly prior to the losses against Usyk. It's going to be interesting to see how much, if anything, he can really genuinely claw back. You know, does he go into a fight against Wilder? Is that a good idea? If you were his manager, would you put him in there? You know, these are all questions, aren't they?
Chris. Slightly different tangent here, but when you talk about ticket sales and filling out arenas and all the rest of it, there is something that I've been meaning to talk about for a little while, and this is the price of tickets today. You know, sometimes, you know, you're looking at 500 quid, 750 quid for a ringside seat. Well, if I go to a fight, you know, I would take my other half or one of my kids or both my kids. Frankly, we're never going to go to boxing at those prices. And we're never going to go where we pay £100 in the nosebleeds to watch them on the big screen above the ring. And I think, obviously, it is a real test of these guys and their drawing power. And I think it's more about people who want to be seen at the occasion. For example, and I think we touched upon this before with Fury and Chisora, no one went to that as a sporting contest, but they went there to say they were at the heavyweight championship fighting in Tottenham or wherever it was. And it's difficult, but it's a bloody hard sell because these prices have gone through the roof.
Yeah, crazy prices. But I mean, I'm guessing, I'm not a promoter, none of us are, that they're priced like that because they can sell them at those kind of prices. Isn't that right?
Well, I suppose you know, we are going on a bit of a tangent here, but obviously I think that the fights are on too late now, you know, in terms of having kids and being up the next morning and all the rest of it. You know, they're starting at 11 or 11:15. You know, you wouldn't put Match of the Day or Darky, you wouldn't be commentating on your primetime football matches at that night because half the people have gone to bed. And boxing
But I think the reason they're that late at night, if I'm not wrong, I think that's a strategic decision because they're trying to catch a lot of people who are maybe coming home from the pub on a Saturday evening and go, oh, let's watch the fight. You know, and maybe you push up the pay-per-view all through the evening as people sit around waiting for it to happen. If you stick it on at 9 o'clock at night, you don't get that maybe extra kick to the figures. I don't know. As I said, I'm not a promoter, but I'm reading it that way.
Yeah, I just feel that it's time to review it because I don't think we're giving ourselves a fighting chance. You know, I've tried with my other half and kids to get them to watch the fights, and if they can make it through an undercard, they can't make it to the main event because they're so tired. I think this is obviously we've gone on a bit of a segue, but it does prove, you know, that you're prepared to, you know, people are prepared to do it. To stay up for the people that they want and to pay the freight for the people that they want. But like you said, John, I think this Joshua one is proving to be a tough sell now.
Well, from what I hear, you know, and it's going to be fascinating to see just how Eddie tries to, you know, sort of rebuild him in public consciousness as the man he once was, because he's fallen a long way. you know, and yeah. I hear him making bullish noises about fighting Deontay Wilder. Is that a good idea? One punch and it could be end of career.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'd go there. I think, you know, this is what you'd call a rehab fight, isn't it, for AJ? I think he's at that stage now where there are all kinds of question marks, and he may be entering that kind of twilight zone where he could be beaten by somebody who wouldn't be fit to be in the same ring with him a few years ago. He's at that vulnerable stage. So I think, you know, if you're selling this fight, I think it is quite a fascinating fight in that regard, because AJ now is at that vulnerable stage. I mean, if he can win it and win it well, yeah, they can go on and put him in with another of those names again. So there's a lot kind of riding on this. So it does have a kind of fascination for me.
Well, there's another caveat here in that Eddie told me a few weeks ago that they were looking for maybe a Dillian Whyte fight in a stadium this summer. And I mean, that's going to be another test of drawing power, isn't it? Like you said, we've seen it. We've already seen it.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't excite me at all, to be honest.
It doesn't set my pulse racing, that one either. I think if people really want to go and spend your 500, 700 quid to watch that, then good luck to them. But I don't think that too many of the people I know who are into boxing would be shelling out that sort of money to see that one.
Who's more popular? I mean, you guys answer. What do you think? AJ or Fury?
Well, right now, Fury.
Yeah, I think Fury's the bigger name. I mean, Fury's, it's crazy. Obviously, I know a little bit about the publishing world and books and that kind of stuff. And Fury's had two, if not three, books out in the last 3 years. And, you can't get a book out on anybody in this day and age. And obviously, you know, he's been on TV. He's done all the stuff. He's done all the rounds. He's got his own Netflix show coming out. He's hugely popular in America as well, where obviously Top Rank and Bob Arum say that, you know, he's the piece of the puzzle that was missing after Muhammad Ali, which is just insane praise. And I think you're right where you said earlier, you know, there's a huge proportion of people that he's been inspired by Fury and his stories of mental health struggles and depression and fighting back from the brink. But there's a lot of people now who also don't buy the shtick and aren't interested in hearing about it any longer and didn't buy into it in the first place. So I think it's strange because, you know, and with Joshua, people love him, think he's wholesome and, you know, kind of Bruno-esque, but also he doesn't put much out there. It doesn't sort of really show his real self, and no one really knows what he's like as a human being because he doesn't let people peel away the layers in interviews or anything else. So again, you've got another divisive figure. So I think while they're both popular and have big numbers and big followings and all the rest of it, they are divisive, unlike your Coopers and your Brunos.
I think Tyson's popularity just exploded after he did those documentaries on ITV, which again is the power of mainstream television. He did that series Meet the Furies, if you like, and I still have people talk to me now about the moment where he's down on a riverbank or a canal bank and some kid talks to him and he sort of thinks about it after he's moved on. He said he's got trouble, that boy, or words to that effect, calls him back and starts to talk to him a whole lot more and talking to him about his mental health issues. And I think that series kind of revealed a human side to Tyson Fury that people haven't seen before. And I think a lot of people bought into that. You know, I've got a mate, and I'm sure you guys will have had people say this as well, but I've got a friend who suffered fairly badly with mental problems over the years. And he said to me after he'd watched that, he said, you know, he said, Tyson Fury has touched me and resonated more with me than any medical expert in any hospital ever has done before. And I think there were thousands and thousands who warmed to Tyson as a result of that.
Yeah, I had a similar story. I was having a coffee with a friend in a coffee shop from not far from me here in the New Forest. And I was having a chat with a friend of mine, and someone overhears a conversation where I'm talking about stuff I've just done with Fury in an interview, and someone comes over, he's seen the interview, and he says, "Oh, next time you see Fury, please tell him that he saved my life with his story. I was going down one road, and I heard his story, and it changed me." And just in the boxing world, Jermell Herring told me something similar, in the sense that Tyson picking the scab and talking about mental health and you know, it being okay to not be okay, has changed a lot of perceptions in boxing. It made Jermell Herring more comfortable talking about it. So it's clearly reached people on a very, very deep level, whether you buy into it personally or not.
And the fact he came back from where he was, from a pretty wretched place in his life, to go and have those three extraordinary fights against Deontay Wilder, which will be etched into boxing folklore, I think, forever.
Yeah, the way he got up in the last round, unbelievably, and all that kind of thing. Yeah, he is right up there, isn't he? Really, with this generation, you'd have to put Tyson Fury, I think, into our argument about the most popular fighters that have ever been. Of course, we weren't around, were we? You know, in the era of people like Jimmy Wilde. I mean, I just wonder what his sort of popularity was in his time. You know, he like the Ring magazine called him number three puncher of all time. He went 103 fights unbeaten at the start of his career. Incredible, really. And somebody like Ted Kidd Lewis and all those fights he had with Jack Britton, you know, the world welterweight champion. Now he was a pioneer. I just wonder what their popularity rating was in their era. I mean, a very different era, of course.
And you look at what their popularity rating would be now with the current, with the current social media world. I think they'd be able to capture the nation. I mean, when you think that they did it anyway, through the power of newspapers and the few people who were able to go along and watch it live. But, you know, if you could put them into the modern era, some of those guys would just be huge, huge stars.
They would. It was a different era. I don't think you'd sell this these days as a pay-per-view happening. I think Jimmy Wilde had 143 fights that had no decision. No decision fights.
That's when they used to give us a few quid when we turned up as newspaper reporters, didn't they? They used to give you an envelope and you made your decision about who you thought had won. Those days sadly are gone.
I think it was even before that, John, I think all of that.
You did touch upon it there in terms of the national stuff as well. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge this, that, you know, we've talked about the Brits and it's just that boxing does reach people, doesn't it, at a very sort of, I don't know, intrinsic level. Because when you look at Jeff Fenech in Australia, or you look at Nino Benvenuti in Italy, and you look at Monzon in Argentina, like, these guys are gods, aren't they? They are absolute gods. You know, Martinez, Sergio Martinez as well. And you just think, you know, there's something about fighters that people really get hold of, isn't there? That, like, they become just so adored and beloved that they transcend the sport massively, don't they?
Yeah, transcend the sport. I mean, yeah, that's, I think, maybe an acid test criteria of a level of popularity. Are you known to people who are not necessarily devotees of the sport? Obviously, you know, so Henry Cooper, Frank Bruno, Barry McGuigan, in the end, Ricky Hatton, AJ Fury, crossed that line, didn't they? I mean, I think Jim Watt and Ken Buchanan did in Scotland as well. And I think there are a lot of people who were like local phenomenons, weren't they? I mean, Jim was massive, wasn't he, in his time when he became world champion rather belatedly. You know, those fights like with Peter Lua and all that at the Kelvin Hall in Glasgow, that was a big scene for a while up there. So, you know, he's still remembered, you know, brilliantly and loved in Scotland.
Yeah. I think the public loved the fact that people, you know, as Jim did, he got fame and a title pretty late on in his career. And, of course, most notably, Frank Bruno, wasn't it? You know, he fought Tim Witherspoon, he fought Mike Tyson, he fought Lennox Lewis. Finally, in 1995, what was perceived to be a last throw of the dice against Oliver McCall, he goes out there and wins it. And I think Joe Public likes the guy who refuses to take his beating, who still believes that he can achieve. And that's what Frank did. And of course, he went so much into the public image, the public eye, didn't he? Through that link with Harry Cooper, through Harry Carpenter, you know what I mean, Harry? And the brown sauce adverts and the places on children in need and the pantomime appearances. You know, I mean, Frank was a part of British culture for a while.
I mean, people were in on the narrative with Frank as well, weren't they? Right from the beginning, he was on peak time, BBC One, Sports Night, all his fights, really from the word go, from his professional debut. So they did a really good job, I think, in marketing him, and he always had the maximum exposure. And they'd followed the story, as you said, John, right the way through, about how he'd written in the mirror at home in the dust when he was a kid, and that he was going to, or his brother had, that he was going to be world heavyweight champion, and it never looked like happening, and then it did. So yeah, that was a fantastic night, of course, a crowning moment for Frank, which I think just made him even more of a national treasure than he even already was.
John, let me ask you this. Where does Joe Calzaghe figure in this conversation about popularity?
Well, do you know, I was actually just going to bring him in as the next person I was going to speak about. In Wales, colossal. You know, I mean, and in boxing, among boxing cognoscenti, I think most people would recognise he is unquestionably one of the very best fighters this country has produced in the history of the sport. But as a national figure, he never quite attained the fame that I believe that somebody with his talent should have done. You know, now why that was, I don't think he was particularly keen at crossing the Severn Bridge, was he? He didn't particularly want to go other than home. He was a bit of a homeboy, loved Wales, and didn't really want to particularly go and play the media game. So he, a brilliant fighter, absolutely right up there, Joe Calzaghe. But when you look at the most popular fighters, you know, Joe didn't rival Frank Bruno, Henry Cooper, Ricky Hatton for national, or the two heavyweights now, for national popularity, despite the fact that he was such a brilliant fighter.
Yeah, I mean, Joe was a simple soul, wasn't he? You're right, he was a home bird. I used to go to that little gym, that little blue gym, the tumble-down Newbridge Rugby Club hut with the gym inside. He'd do the sparring and the workout with his dad there. And he was happy with all of that. Train every day, go home, watch the TV, preferably if Juventus were on, you know, because of his Italian roots as well. And yeah, he was happy with that, really. I mean, I think really all the big tributes for Joe came pretty late in his career. I think it was a long period where if you'd gone and asked 100 people in the street, who's Joe Calzaghe, not very many would have been able to tell you. But I think by the end, he had acquired a kind of stardom. But I think you're right, John. I don't think he ever kind of crossed into that area where he was up there with a Henry Cooper or Bruno in terms of popularity. Maybe he should have done because of his ability.
He only really got the big push, didn't he? When, you know, Frank Warren did his big deal with ITV in, what was it, 2005, and the deal was done with ITV believing that they were getting Ricky Hatton as their marquee act. Now, there was the breakdown in the relationship between Ricky and Frank, with his dad Ray involved in that, and you know, and things went sour there, and it wound up with Ricky Hatton leaving Frank, going to fight on Sky, linking up with Dennis Hobson, and as a result of that void, if you like, Frank had to produce somebody as a headline act, as a star act for primetime television. He'd got Amir Khan, but he also pushed very heavily on Joe Calzaghe, and hence you got the Lacey fights, the Kessler fight, and belatedly, he got the acclaim that really he had deserved for a long time before that, you know, with fights like Charles Brewer and Byron Mitchell. You know, he'd been a very good fighter for a long time, but at last people were realizing just how good he was. And with the result of those big fights, you know, 50,000 people or thereabouts turned up at the National Rugby Stadium in Cardiff, and that was unthinkable 4 or 5 years earlier.
I don't know if you've seen the tweet from Enzo Macronelli over the weekend. He posted a picture. I think it was a Richard Maynard publicity stunt when he was at Frank Warren's Sports Network, and he got Matt Crinelli and a load of other championship holders to pose in the nude with their belts around their waists, you know, well, around more than their waists, to cover up their indiscretions. And anyway, Enzo tagged in Joe Calzaghe and said Joe phoned in sick for this one. And Joe tweeted back and said, yeah, I wonder why. But I think Maynard had all sorts of problems getting Joe to do all that kind of media stuff. Like you said at the top, John, it just wasn't for him. He didn't like it. He wasn't about that life at all. He was a very simple, straightforward fighting man. He was there to box someone's head off, and inevitably he did it.
Well, he's quite shy, isn't he? You know, you meet him to this day, and the first thing that strikes you about Joe is that he is, in the nicest sense of the word, an ordinary Joe.
Yeah, I mean, the story went, I don't know if it's true, this, but somebody told me it, and it sounds true, that they got Joe to open a supermarket down in South Wales one day, and he went up to the microphone and said, he goes, yeah, well, I hope you all enjoy coming shopping here. He goes, I don't shop here myself, I go down to Asda, but...
I think I've heard something similar to that. Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. Typical Joe, truthful as the day is long. Great stuff. Yeah. And then let me throw these names at you in terms of guys that didn't really catch on. Carl Thompson, who was involved in war after war after war. Yeah. And then Johnny Nelson, who wasn't involved in wars, but looked the part, talked the part, and had an incredibly long reign. Neither of them really got anywhere close to this crossover appeal, did they?
Well, Johnny wasn't an exciting fighter, was he? You know, I don't think any promoter in the world could have put Johnny Nelson forward as an exciting fighter. Capable, difficult to beat, and really did make the most of the ability that he had in a long career. But he was never going to be a big marquee fighter.
Yeah, I think he lost his first three, didn't he, Johnny? I mean, I really admired the way he made himself into a successful fighter, but yeah, he was in rather too many very boring fights, particularly the Carlos De Leon one, and was it James Waring, I think I said in the commentary at about the 10th round of that fight, this is only marginally more interesting than listening to the speaking clock. I mean, it was that kind of experience. But you know, Johnny, he made his money, he got his wins, he got his world title, and he's had a fantastically successful television career. So good luck to him.
Well, look, you both said, oh, yeah, he's in dull fights. Well, okay, I present to you Carl Thompson, never in a dull fight. He didn't cross over. So what's the deal there then, John?
Not a good talker. I think, that shouldn't be a factor. But, I mean, if we were talking to Carl now, I suspect that he would admit that he didn't really enjoy talking about boxing with a microphone in front of him. And unfortunately, you know, like it or not, that's so important. You know, you look again at another guy, Carl Froch. You know, Carl didn't really enthuse the greater British boxing public, the greatest British sporting public, rather, until he had those two amazing fights right at the end of his career against George Groves. You had the great rivalry, and that captured public imagination to the extent that they could fill Wembley. But the difference between somebody like Carl and Carl Thompson was that Carl Froch was always a decent talker. Carl Thompson, I'm afraid to say, wasn't.
Yeah. What about Dennis Andres? Let's throw him into the mix as well. Another guy who had a, you know, successful career, in the end turned himself into a journeyman fighter, into a world champion, always pretty good value for money. I loved watching Carl Thompson's fight, by the way. That's a shame that he deserved to be a bit bigger than he was, I think, Carl. What about Alan Minter and Maurice Hope? There's another couple, you know, where do they stand in our popularity stakes?
John, where are you with Minter? Because obviously it's difficult not to talk about Minter without going to the Hagler night, isn't it? But where, you know, overall, because at the same time, you know, there was a touch of the sort of Cooper nostalgia that Minter got some sort of rub from, didn't he? He was always hugely respected in boxing in the boxing fraternity, you know, these after dinner speaking engagements and border control awards dues and stuff, there was real reverence and nostalgia and affection for Alan Minter. But how was that in terms of reaching out beyond the boxing world?
I think he was very, you know, you touched on it. I mean, I think he was very much tainted by that Hagler fight, and there's no way that you can lessen that. They were apparently reconciled afterwards and became, you know, not friends exactly, but there was no longer bitterness between them. But what happened that night was something which was shameful to boxing, and right or wrong, I think Alan played his part in it happening.
And how about Maurice Hope?
Well, he's a bit before my time. Ian's more Maurice Hope sort of man.
Yeah, I mean, he was part of the Terry Lawless, you know, the pantheon of champions, if you like. But yeah, he's another guy who just always seemed to be flying under the radar to me. He made headlines on the nights of his fights, but there was never really any big publicity built up around him. I think, you know, it was at the time when the people like Lloyd Hannigan was coming through at the gym as well, and Frank Bruno was obviously the star of the Lawless gym. So, yeah, he's another one who probably should have been a little bit bigger than he wants. Going back to Alan Minter, yeah, I was there that night of the Hagler fight, and it really was frightening, because people were throwing full bottles. I mean, it wasn't like these days where they were plastic bottles. They were real bottles being hurled from on high, the Wembley Conference Centre, into the ring. So Empire Pool Wembley, wasn't it? You know, and Hagler was there having won the title, being shielded by all his camp, trying to cover him up. And it was a mighty dangerous place to be. I was with Des Lynam, who was doing the commentary, and we were hiding underneath the ring apron doing the broadcast. It was that bad. So sadly for Alan, who, you know, he'd won the title, undisputed title, away from home in Las Vegas against Vito Antuofermo, and reveled in that. I mean, it was his considerable misfortune, really, to run into somebody as good as Hagler straight away.
And John, let me ask you this. Let me put this name to you. Amir Khan.
Well, Amir, well, you can almost on the back of that add Audley Harrison as well, who got huge status as a result of winning a medal at the Olympics. But Amir, you know, I mean, he won a medal at the age of 17. His early career was brilliantly stage managed. All his early fights were on ITV, and he was fighting against journeymen and getting big audience figures. And as his career progressed, I think the appeal, or the one of the reasons that people loved seeing Amir fight, apart from that he's a good-looking guy and talks well, was that vulnerability. There was always the possibility that he was going to get chinned. We saw it early in his career against Willie Limond. We saw it against Bradis Prescott, you know, and then the storyline went on and on from there. And Ian commentated and saw a fair few of his fights as well. It was the vulnerability of Amir, I think, which made him an act and a fighter who you couldn't take your eyes off.
He did have charisma, though, didn't he, Amir Khan? People cared about him. They wanted to watch his fights. And that all came, of course, from him being a teenage Olympic star. So I think he had an interesting career, didn't he? I think there was a tendency, you know, after what happened against Bradis Prescott in particular, you know, all over in 54 seconds, blown away, sensational reverse, that maybe that was the end of his story. But it wasn't, was it? I think he showed later on that he passed what the Americans call a gut check or two along the way. So, you know, later on, he's reinvented himself as a sort of reality TV star as well. So, and I liked dealing with Amir.
Yes, yeah, I did.
It's an interesting thing. I think, you know, I think Amir had a lot of friends in the press pack because he was always easy to deal with, and he was non-confrontational and happy to answer any questions about anything. And like you said, Ian, he became quite famous with this second burst of fame in the I'm a Celebrity thing. But there was a period, John, where he went over to America and he had quite a few fights. Danny Garcia, Lamont Peterson, Zab Judah, Marcus Maidana, all big fights.
Yeah.
But, you know, you wouldn't I don't know, would you see an AJ or a Fury having all of their marquee fights in America away from the UK fight fans? I mean, I don't know. He was Khan was trying to make something work with Golden Boy, but I'm not sure that he didn't lose a bit of momentum by going over there for his prime years. What do you think?
Yeah, that's quite possibly so. But, you know, you talk about those names that you mentioned there. Would you have been able to have got them at that stage with the way the sport was at that time? Could you have got all those over to fight in the UK? You know, I'm not convinced you could. And I think as a result of him taking those fights, I mean, the Maidana fight was extraordinary, wasn't it? As a result of Amir taking those contests and fighting his way through them, I think he got an enormous amount of respect on the other side of the pond. And that's when he looks at what is a sizable fortune that he won through his fights, through his long and by and large very successful boxing career. I think that's, you know, to a large extent due to the fact that he has such a high profile and such respect in the United States.
Well, let me say this, John. So you might not have been able to get those guys over through that period of time, but you could have got Kell Brook and Wembley.
Well, you could.
Now, you know, imagine how big that would have been, prime for prime, in this country.
Yeah,
I think
sadly,
that would have been massive. I mean, by the time it happened, it was, you know, it's forever going to have an asterisk by it because it didn't really matter.
That's the old story, though, isn't it, Trish? You know, so many fights happened way too late. Just only happened when both of them needed the money right at the end of their careers. So, yeah, I mean, he did lose something. You're quite right, I think, by not having enough of his fights in England. But he made his money in some, you know, big HBO fights in America.
True. John, I wanted to just see this thing about McGuigan and Hatton because they're the ones that sort of had this. I can't really call it slow burn because they were popular from the start, but there's a real excitement with these guys when they emerge, isn't there? And you see the momentum, you see them filling out town halls, see them filling out smaller arenas, then you see them filling out big arenas, then you start taking it to the stadiums. It's exciting to be part of that journey, to cover that journey, isn't it? When you see this phenomenon sort of taking shape.
Well, there's a romance about it as well, isn't there? You know, I mean, Barry had his fights at Ulster Hall and then moved on to King's Hall in Belfast and then had his big fight ultimately when he got his world title at Loftus Road against Pedroza in 1985. But he was so much a man of his community. He united Northern Ireland at a time when Northern Ireland was so horribly split. And one thing which both sides, be it Catholic or Protestant, they all cheered Barry McGuigan. He was a man of all the people. Ricky Hatton, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people felt that he was one of them. You know, so many people probably literally had a pint with Ricky over the years on his rise. By the time he fought Costa Zou in 2005, 20 years after Barry, and got his world title opportunity, he'd got this phenomenal Mancunian fight base behind him. And of all the boxing nights I've been involved in, that one where he beat Costa Zou was right up there for passionate support and kind of a fighter as man of the people coming on and succeeding.
And Ian, let me put this to you about David Haye. How big would he have been if he had had his biggest fights over here? When you think he fought Jean-Marc Mormet for the cruiserweight titles over in France, he then fought Valuev for the heavyweight title over in, I think it was Nuremberg, and then he fought Klitschko in Hamburg in a fight that was a complete washout. So, I mean, say those fights were at home, and then obviously I suppose this is where we get a little bit hypothetical. Say he beats Klitschko. How big does he become then?
Oh, if he beats Klitschko, but that's a pretty big if.
In terms of what happened.
Where he was all full of talk before the fight and put in what was a pretty pathetic effort, to be honest with you. He didn't lay it on the line. He left an awful lot undone in the fight and probably might die wondering one day about that, about what might have happened that night. Yeah, should have had more fights in the UK. But another fighter we haven't really touched on here you know, is Lloyd Hunnigan in the Unsung Stakes, who probably should have been more popular, massively talented fighter, you know, beat the guy who was regarded as pound for pound number one at the time, Don Curry, away from home in Atlantic City, but didn't even finish in the top three, I remember, in the Sports Personality of the Year that year, which I thought was a crying shame, because his was probably the number one sporting achievement of 1986. But, you know, he had to live with that, the ragamuffin man, as he'd like to call himself.
It goes down, that one, as one of, it's still, I know people like to talk about this, and I know it's been said many times before, but that has to go down as one of the very best performances by a British fighter going to America. And the fact that nobody really beyond Mickey Duff and possibly Lloyd and one or two others, the fact that nobody really gave him much of a chance. It was an extraordinary performance. And I guess it was his unfortunate undoing to run into Marlon Starling a little bit later on, who was a little bit too good for him.
Yeah, and those two really hated each other as well. Really hated each other. I had a bizarre experience with Marlon Starling where he said, yeah, come to my hotel room. We'll do an interview. So I come to the hotel room and he's in bed. He's lying in bed and the room's completely dark. And he said, you're going to have to talk to me while I'm lying in bed. I got to rest up. He said, what's Hunnigan doing? What's Hunnigan said to you? I said, well, he thinks he's going to win the fight, of course. I said, you know, and he thinks he's got your number. He goes, switch the machine on. I'll tell you something different. And it was like, and he really hated Hunnigan. I mean, it was nothing phony at all. But yeah, he got the better of him for certain that night, did Marlon Starling, but quite a curious character.
So tell me, what was the disconnect then, chaps, for Lloyd Hunnigan? Why didn't he get this sort of hero's welcome and kick on from there in terms of the British public?
Well, I don't think it helped that he didn't like his promoter, did it? He and Mickey Duff were daggers drawn quite a lot of the time. You know, Mickey famously said, "This, you know, you don't have to love a man, you don't have to like a man to promote him. We don't have to be friends." But I think if they'd got on a little bit better, if that had been a less spiky relationship, I think it might have been better.
Yeah, I just can't. Sometimes you just can't put your finger on it. I can't give you a reason because his exploits in the ring deserved a greater level of stardom. But, you know, going back to the beginning of all of this and how we started, there's two different lists here, aren't there? The best fighters that Britain's ever produced and the most popular. And yeah, they're quite different lists, I would suggest.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think so. And then I think you could probably have a third list in terms of divisive fighters as well, because I just think that there's those ones like your Nazis that just, they were clearly popular because their numbers were through the roof. But did everyone love them? They didn't. That just wasn't the way that things went out.
If Colin Hart was sitting here talking to us now, he obviously goes back a few years beyond Ian and I, and he'd say, let's talk about Billy Walker. You know, Billy never won anything, but he filled out Wembley Arena, I think, 5, 6 or 7 times. He was amazingly popular back in the 60s. And it just goes to show he was somebody who captured particularly London sporting opinion. And he was a great favourite of the people. But actually, when it came down to ability, he wasn't as good as Henry Cooper, and he never really quite got there.
Well, he was even a ticket seller in the amateurs, wasn't he, for the big fights against America and stuff. People would flock to see Billy Walker's fights in the amateurs.
The blonde bomber. He always used to go to the fights for years afterwards. You'd see him almost every way.
Yeah.
Great, good looking lad. His book's a good read. It's fair to say, he made the most of his appeal.
Yeah, good lad. So brilliant, guys. Well, this has been plenty of fun. It's nice to be able to reconvene with you. I know that you've both been extremely busy, and thanks to you for taking the time to listen to this latest episode of Ringside. Let me edit that. This latest episode of Ringside Rewind. I'm getting the guys heckling me now, which doesn't happen too often. But gents, this has been plenty of fun. If you have enjoyed this, please do rate and review this podcast where you possibly can. And we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.